A third criticism of differentiation is I'm just too nice to implement something like 20-70-10. Usually people with this complaint about differentiation assert that differentiation as a managerial system does not value people who add intangible things to a business, like a feeling of family or humanity or a sense of history. And we all know of organizations that continue to employ underperformers for a long time, mainly because they are really nice individuals. I fully understand not wanting to manage out somebody nice, but the fact is protecting underperformers always backfires. First of all, by not carrying their weight, they make the pie smaller for everyone. That can cause resentment. It's also not what you would call fair. An unfair culture never helps a company win. It undermines trust and candor too much. The worst thing, though, is how protecting people who don't perform hurts the people themselves. For years, they are carried along with everyone looking the other way. At appraisals, they are vaguely told they are great or just doing fine. They're thanked for their contribution. Then a downturn occurs and layoffs are necessary. The so-called nice underperformers are always almost the first to go and always the most surprised because no one has ever told them the truth about their results or lack thereof. The awful thing is that this often happens when the underperformers are in their late 40s or 50s. They've been carried along for most of their careers. Then suddenly, at an age when starting over can be very tough, they're out of a job with no preparation or planning and a kick in the stomach they may never get over. They feel betrayed, and they should. As harsh as it may seem at first, differentiation prevents that tragedy because it is based on performance measures that really count. That's why I believe you are never too nice to implement 20-70-10, only too cowardly. Another favorite criticism, differentiation pits people against one another and undermines teamwork. Try telling that to Joe Torre. The New York Yankees function perfectly well as a team, much to the dismay of Red Sox fans like myself, I might add, with a highly transparent system of differentiation in place. Stars are lavishly rewarded. Underperformers are shown the clubhouse exit. And if that's not enough to make a system of differentiation perfectly clear, the players' salaries are very public. You can have no doubt that differentiation is going on when some team members make $18 million a year and others wearing the same uniform make the major league minimum of $300,000 a year. And yet everyone pulls together for the team to win. Alex Rodriguez loves the thrill of hitting a Grand Slam home run, but I'm sure it feels a lot better to him when the Yankees win. In July 2004, Derek Jeter made the catch of the year, diving into the stands and coming up with a black eye and a cut face, a photo of which graced every newspaper in New York. A lot of the pain had to be relieved when the Yankees won, coming from behind in the 13th inning in one of the great baseball games of all time. Without question, these two stars love to excel for their own sakes, but you can bet it's always more fun and exciting when the team wins. Their teamwork is a testament to two other things. First, great leadership. Joe Torre obviously understands the challenges of managing in a differentiation environment. Second, the cohesiveness of the Yankees and of so many other sports teams shows the positive impact of an open, honest management system built on performance assessments and aligned rewards. In that way, differentiation doesn't undermine teamwork, it enhances it. In business, there probably would be pandemonium if companies started publishing everyone's salary. And I'm not advocating that here. And yet people always seem to know what their coworkers are making, don't they? That's why they get mad when everyone on a team gets rewarded the same way when only a few people have done the work. They feel cheated and wonder why management can't see the obvious, that not every team member is created equal. Differentiation rewards those members of the team who deserve it. By the way, that annoys only the underperformers. To everyone else, it seems fair. Any fair environment promotes teamwork. Better yet, it motivates people to give their all. And that's what you want. Another favorite criticism is, differentiation is only possible in the United States. I wish I could implement it, but because of our cultural values, the people in my country simply won't accept it. I've heard this critique of differentiation since its earliest days at GE, when one of our managers explained that 20-70-10 couldn't be implemented in Japan because in that culture, politeness was valued far more than candor. Since then, I've heard the national culture excuse from people in hundreds of companies in dozens of nations. Recently, managers in Denmark told us that their country values egalitarianism too much for differentiation to be widely accepted. We've heard that case made in France, too. A manager in a meeting in Amsterdam told us last year there was too much Calvinism in Dutch bones for the system to work in the Netherlands. I guess the manager believed all rewards come only in heaven if you're chosen to get there. And in China, we heard that differentiation is a long time coming because in most state-owned enterprises, still representing more than 50% of the economy despite market reforms, many of the best jobs and rewards go to the most loyal members of the party, whether they are the most talented or not. Basically, I think the excuses we hear about differentiation's cultural obstacles are just that, excuses. At GE, we couldn't have a company where differentiation existed only in our U.S. operations. First of all, we just believed too much in differentiation's effectiveness. But we also knew that having differentiation only in the United States would have been unfair and confusing, especially for the businesses with both U.S. and global divisions, and for the people who moved around the world for us. We decided early on that we would push through differentiation everywhere we did business, dealing with whatever cultural issues that confronted us. Then an amazing thing happened. Very many cultural issues didn't confront us. Once we made the case for differentiation and we linked it to a candid performance appraisal system, it worked as well in Japan as it did in Ohio. In fact, people who at first thought it could never work in that country came to support it strongly for its honesty, fairness, and clarity. As I mentioned, very often when I get the comment, "We can't have differentiation in my country," it comes from managers who admit they themselves support the approach. Their resistance grows out of the assumption that their people will object based on cultural values. My advice to them is to move slowly, but to go for it anyway. They will be surprised that they are not alone, because differentiation, once in practice for a while, makes its own case in any language. Another complaint about differentiation goes like this. Differentiation is fine for the top 20% and the bottom 10 because they know where they're going, but it's enormously demotivating for the middle 70% who end up living in an awful kind of limbo. Again, there's an element of truth in this complaint. The middle 70% is the hardest category to manage in differentiation. The biggest problem comes with the individuals in the top tier of the 70%, because they know they are not a whole lot different from the top 20 performers, and often a whole lot better than the bottom tier of their own crowd. And yes, that can be enervating, and sometimes talented middle 70 people leave because of it. The silver lining to this difficult situation is that the existence of a middle 70 forces companies to manage themselves better. It forces leaders to scrutinize people more closely than they would ordinarily and to provide more consistent, candid feedback. It pushes companies to build training centers that really make a difference. For instance, before differentiation, our Crotonville, New York Training Center was often used in the 1970s as a warehouse where businesses could afford to send their underperformers. It was like a way station on the road to early retirement. The rigor of 2070-10 helped us change that. We turned Crotonville into a place where the top 20 and the best of the middle 70 talked about ideas, debated our approach to business, and got to know and understand one another a lot better. And since senior management spent several hours with each class, it also gave us a rough idea as to just how rigorously differentiation was being practiced in the field. Another piece of silver lining is that while being in the middle 70% can be demotivating to some, it actually revs the engine of many others. For the people in the top 20, for instance, the very existence of a middle 70 gives them yet another reason to pull out all the stops every day. They have to keep getting better to keep their high standing. What a rush that can be. After all, most people want to improve and grow every day. For a lot of people in the middle 70, getting better is energizing too. Getting into the top 20 gives them a tangible goal, and having that goal makes them work harder, think more creatively, share more ideas, and overall fight the good fight every day. It makes work more of a challenge and a lot more fun. Finally, critics like to say, differentiation favors people who are energetic and extroverted and undervalues people who are shy and introverted, even if they are talented. I don't know if it's good or bad, but the world generally favors people who are energetic and extroverted. That's also something you learn young, and it's reinforced in school, at church, at camp, in clubs, and usually at home too. By the time you get to work, if you are still shy and introverted and somewhat low in energy, there are professions and jobs where those characteristics are advantageous. If you know yourself, you will find them. This criticism of differentiation, which I hear now and then, is not really about differentiation, but about society's values. I might add that in business, energetic and extroverted people generally do better, but results speak for themselves, loud and clear, and differentiation hears them. If you want the best people on your team, you need to face up to differentiation. I don't know of any people management system that does it better, with more transparency, fairness, and speed. It isn't perfect by any means, but differentiation, like candor, clarifies business and makes it run better in every way. The final chapter in this management philosophy section is about voice and dignity. It really means getting every brain in the game. Rudy Giuliani, the former mayor of New York, has a saying, "Know what you believe." I think he's right. So I want to conclude this section of the book with one of my core beliefs. I mention it because it is the hinge for every principle you've just heard about: mission and values, candor and differentiation. The belief is this: every person in the world wants voice and dignity, and every person deserves them. By voice, I mean people want the opportunity to speak their minds and have their ideas, opinions, and feelings heard, regardless of their nationality, gender, age, or culture. By dignity, I mean people inherently and instinctively want to be respected for their work and effort and individuality. If you've just read the above and said, "Well, obviously," then fine. I'm assuming that most people are having that response. And maybe the belief in voice and dignity doesn't even need to be stated. It's so widely accepted, and its importance is so self-evident. But I've been surprised over the past couple of years at how often I end up coming back to this value when I talk about winning. Last year in China, a young woman in the audience stood and literally in tears asked how any business person in her country could practice candor and differentiation when only the voice of the boss is allowed. We, the people underneath, have so many ideas, but we cannot even imagine speaking them until we are the boss, she said. That is fine if you are an entrepreneur and start your own company. Then you are the boss, she said. but some of us are not able to do that. I said that in the early days of GE's operations in China, I had seen the difficulties she had just described at our factories in Nansha, Shanghai, and Beijing. But as the plants developed and business practices evolved, I had seen an enormous improvement in how the Chinese leaders who worked for GE were listening to employees. I told her that I was confident that, with China's expanding market economy and the maturation of its management practices, a more inclusive approach would eventually spread. But the repression of voice and dignity is hardly a Chinese problem. In fact, while the Chinese woman was very emotional in her questioning, people in every country I visited share some of her frustration and concern on this matter. Now, when you're running a unit or a division, you rarely think that people aren't speaking up or they're not respected. It feels like the people around you certainly are, and your days are filled with visits, calls, and notes from people with strong opinions. But it ends up that what you experience is a skewed example. The majority of people in most organizations don't say anything because they feel they can't and because they haven't been asked. That became clear to me in the late 1980s, just about every time I had a marathon session at our training center in Crotonville. Detailed questions about local business issues, questions that should have been answered back on home turf, were thrown at me from every direction. Why is the refrigeration plant getting all the new equipment while we're letting laundry suffer? And what are we moving the GE90 engine assembly to Durham for when we can do it right here in Evendale? Were a couple of the questions. In frustration, after several such questions, I'd invariably stop the class to ask, "Why aren't you asking those questions to your own bosses?" The answer would come back, "I can't bring that up. I'd get killed." "Why can you ask me?" I'd say. "Because we feel anonymous here." After a year or so of these kinds of exchanges, we realized we had to do something to create an environment back in the businesses where people at every level would speak out the way they did at Crotonville. The workout process was born. These were 2 or 3 day events held at GE sites around the world, patterned after New England town meetings. Groups of 30 to 100 employees would come together with an outside facilitator to discuss better ways of doing things and how to eliminate some of the bureaucracy and roadblocks that were hindering them. The boss would be present at the beginning of each session, laying out the rationale for the workout. He or she would also commit to 2 things, to give an on-the-spot yes or no to 75% of the recommendations that came out of the session, and to resolve the remaining 25% within 30 days. The boss would then disappear until the end of the session, so as not to stifle open discussion, returning only at the end to make good on his or her promise. Tens of thousands of these sessions took place over several years until they became a way of life in the company. They are no longer big events, but part of how GE goes about solving problems. Whether it was a refrigeration plant in Louisville, Kentucky, where employees debated faster and better paint systems, or a jet engine plant in Rutland, Vermont, where employees had recommendations on how to cut cycle time in blade manufacturing, or a credit card processing facility in Cincinnati, where employees had ideas about billing efficiency, workouts led to an explosion in productivity. They brought every brain into the game. A middle-aged appliance worker who was at one workout spoke for thousands of people when he told me, "For 25 years you paid for my hands when you could have had my brains as well, for nothing." At last, because of workout, we were getting both. In fact, I believe workout was responsible for one of the most profound changes in GE during my time there. For the vast majority of employees, the boss knows all culture disappeared. A big bureaucracy like GE needed something as systematized as workout to break the ice and get people to open up. But it is not the only method to make sure your team or company is getting every voice heard. Find an approach that feels right to you. I'm not saying that everyone's opinions should be put into practice or every single complaint needs to be satisfied. That's what management judgment is all about. Obviously, some people have better ideas than others. Some people are smarter or more experienced or more creative. But everyone should be heard and respected. They want it, and you need it. We're now moving to the second part of the book entitled Your Company. This has a number of chapters that relate to the inner workings of your company. The first one is leadership, and it has a rather different subtitle. It's not just about you. One day, you become a leader. On Monday, you're doing what comes naturally, enjoying your job, running a project, talking and laughing with colleagues about life and work, and gossiping about how stupid management can be. Then on Tuesday, you are management. You're a boss. Suddenly, everything feels different. Because it is different. Leadership requires distinct behaviors and attitudes. And for many people, they debut with the job. Before you are a leader, success is all about growing yourself. When you become a leader, success is all about growing others. Without question, there are lots of ways to be a leader. You need to look only as far as the freewheeling, savvy, straight-talking Herb Kelleher, who ran Southwest Airlines for 30 years, and Microsoft's quiet, brilliant innovator Bill Gates, to know that leaders come in all varieties. In politics, take Churchill and Gandhi. In football, take Lombardi and Belichick. Each of these leaders would give you a different set of leadership rules. If asked, I would give you 8. They didn't feel like rules when I was using them. They just felt like the right way to lead. This is not the last you will hear of leadership in this book. Virtually every chapter touches on the subject, from crisis management to strategy to work-life balance. But I'm starting with a separate chapter on leadership because it's always on people's minds. Over the past 3 years, during my talks with students, managers, and entrepreneurs, leadership questions invariably were asked. What does a leader really do, for instance? And I was just promoted, and I've never run anything before. How can I be a good leader? Once in Chicago, an audience member said, I have at least 2 direct reports who are smarter than I am. How can I possibly appraise them? These kinds of questions have pushed me to make sense of my own leadership experiences over 40 years. Across the decades, circumstances varied widely. I ran teams with 3 people and divisions with 30,000. I managed businesses that were dying and ones that were bursting with growth. There were acquisitions, divestitures, organizational crises, moments of unexpected luck, good economies, and bad. And yet some ways of leading always seemed to work. They became my rules. Here they are. 1. Leaders relentlessly upgrade their team, using every encounter as an opportunity to evaluate, coach, and build self-confidence. 2. Leaders make sure people not only see the vision, they live and breathe it. 3. Leaders get into everyone's skin, exuding positive energy and optimism. 4. Leaders establish trust with candor, transparency, and credit. 5. Leaders have the courage to make unpopular decisions and gut calls. 6. Leaders probe and push with a curiosity that borders on skepticism, making sure their questions are answered with action. 7. Leaders inspire risk-taking and learning by setting the example. And finally, 8. Leaders celebrate. Before we look at each rule, a word on paradoxes. Leadership is loaded with them. The granddaddy of them all is the short-long paradox, as in the question I often get, how can I manage quality results and still do what's right for my business 5 years out? My answer is, welcome to the job. Look, anyone can manage for the short term. Just keep squeezing the lemon. And anyone can manage for the long. Just keep dreaming. You were made a leader because someone believed you could squeeze and dream at the same time. They saw in you a person with enough insight, experience, and rigor to balance the conflicting demands of short and long-term results. Performing balancing acts every day is, in fact, leadership. Take Rule 3 and Rule 6. One says you should show positive energy and optimism, showering your people with a can-do attitude. The other says you should constantly question your people and take nothing they say for granted. Or Rule 5 and 7. One says you need to act like a boss, asserting authority. The other says you need to admit mistakes and embrace people who take risks, especially when they fail. Of course, life would be easier if leadership was just a list of simple rules, but paradoxes are inherent to the trade. That's part of the fun of leading, though. Each day is a challenge. It's a brand new chance to get better at a job that, when all is said and done, you can never be perfect at. You can only give it everything you've got. Here's how. Back to Rule 1. Leaders relentlessly upgrade their team, using every encounter as an opportunity to evaluate, coach, and build self-confidence. After the Boston Red Sox finally broke an 86-year drought and won the World Series, you couldn't turn on the TV or open a paper without hearing speculation as to why 2004 was the year. There were theories about everything, from center fielder Johnny Damon's hairstyle to the lunar eclipse. Most people agreed, however, that the reason wasn't mysterious at all. The Red Sox had the best players. The pitching staff was the league's best. The fielders were good enough. And the hitters, well, they were sensational. And they were all bound together by a winning spirit, so palpable you could feel it in the air. Now, there are lucky breaks and bad calls in any season, but the team with the best players usually does win. And that is why, very simply, you need to invest the majority of your time and energy as a leader in three activities. You have to evaluate, making sure the right people are in the right jobs, supporting and advancing those who are, and moving out those who are not. You have to coach, guiding, critiquing, and helping people to improve their performance in every way. And finally, you have to build self-confidence, pouring out encouragement, caring, and recognition. Self-confidence energizes, and it gives your people the courage to stretch, take risks, and achieve beyond their dreams. It's the fuel of winning teams. Too often, managers think that people development occurs once a year in performance reviews. That's not even close. People development should be a daily event, integrated into every aspect of your regular goings-on. Take budget reviews. They're a perfect occasion to focus on people. That's right, people. Yes, you have to talk about the business and its results, but in a budget review, you can really see team dynamics in action. If everyone around the table sits silent and frozen while the team leader pontificates, you've got some serious coaching to do. If everyone's involved in the presentation and the whole team is alive, you've got a great opportunity to give immediate feedback that you like what you see. If the team has a real star or dud in its midst, share your impressions with its leader as soon as you can. There is no event in your day that cannot be used for people development. Customer visits are a chance to evaluate your sales force. Plant tours are an opportunity to meet promising new line managers and see if they have the ability to run something bigger. A coffee break at a meeting is an opportunity to coach a team member who's about to give his first major presentation. And remember, in all these encounters, evaluating and coaching are great. But building self-confidence is, in the end, probably the most important thing you can do. Take every opportunity to inject self-confidence into those who have earned it. Use ample praise. The more specific, the better. Besides its huge impact on upgrading the team, the best thing about using every encounter for people development is how much fun it is. Instead of mind-numbing meetings about numbers and plant tours showing off new machines, every day is about growing people. In fact, you think of yourself as a gardener with a watering can in one hand and a can of fertilizer in the other. Occasionally, you have to pull some weeds, but most of the time, you just nurture and tend. Then watch everything bloom. Rule number two. Leaders make sure people not only see the vision, they live and breathe it. It goes without saying that leaders have to set the team's vision, and most do. But there's so much more to the vision thing than that. As a leader, you have to make the vision come alive. How do you do that? First of all, no jargon. Goals cannot sound noble but vague. Targets cannot be so blurry they can't be hit. Your direction has to be so vivid that if you randomly woke up one of your employees in the middle of the night and asked him, "Where are we going?" in a half-asleep stupor, he could still answer, "We're going to keep improving our service to individual contractors and expand our market by aggressively reaching out to small wholesalers." I had just that kind of experience last year when I was out hawking an investment fund for Clayton, Dubilier & Rice, where I consult. At one dinner session in Chicago, the room was filled with about a dozen investors, all focused on our investment criteria and projections for returns. Steve Klimkowski, the chief investment officer of Northwestern Memorial Healthcare, was one of them. But in the midst of all the financial chatter, he was just as interested in talking about his hospital's mission to deliver excellent patient care from the patient's perspective. He had examples of how employees at every level, including him, the investment guy, had transformed their work to fulfill the vision. He had been coached, for example, never to give outpatients directions to a location in the hospital, but to walk them there. At his performance review, Steve had been asked to list several ways in which he personally had improved the patient's experience at Northwestern Memorial. In fact, Steve's understanding of his role in achieving the mission and his passion for it were so real that after talking to him for 15 minutes, you could wake me in the middle of the night and I could tell you about it. Clearly, Northwestern Memorial's leaders had communicated the hospital vision with amazing clarity and consistency. And that's the point. You have to talk about vision constantly, basically to the point of gagging. There were times I talked about the company's direction so many times in one day that I was completely sick of hearing it myself. But I realized the message was always new to someone. And so you keep on repeating it. And you talk to everyone. One of the most common problems in organizations is that leaders communicate the vision to their closest colleagues, and its implications never filter down to people in frontline positions. Think about all the times you've bumped into a rude or harried clerk at a high-service department store, or been put on hold by a call center operator at a company that promises speed and convenience. Somehow, they haven't heard the mission. Maybe because it wasn't shouted in their direction, loud enough or often enough, or maybe the rewards weren't aligned. And that's the final piece of this particular leadership rule. If you want people to live and breathe the vision, show them the money when they do, be it with salary, bonus, or significant recognition of some sort. To quote a friend of mine, Chuck Ames, the former chairman and CEO of Reliance Electric, "Show me a company's various compensation plans, and I'll show you how its people behave." Vision is an essential element of the leader's job, but no vision is worth the paper it's printed on unless it is communicated constantly and reinforced with rewards. Only then will it leap off the page and come to life. Rule number three, leaders get into everyone's skin, exuding positive energy and optimism. You know that old saying, the fish rots from the head. It's mainly used to refer to how politics and corruption filter down in an organization. But it could just as easily be used to describe the effect of a bad attitude at the top of any team, large or small. Eventually, everyone's infected. The leader's mood is, for lack of a better word, catching. You've seen the dynamic 100 times. An upbeat manager who goes through the day with a positive outlook somehow ends up running a team or organization filled with, well, upbeat people with positive outlooks. A pessimistic sourpuss somehow ends up with an unhappy tribe all his own. Unhappy tribes have a tough time winning. Of course, sometimes there are good reasons to be down. The economy is bad, competition is brutal, whatever. Work can be hard. But your job as leader is to fight the gravitational pull of negativism. That doesn't mean you sugarcoat the challenges your team faces. It does mean you display an energizing, can-do attitude about overcoming them. It means you get out of your office and into everyone's skin, really caring about what they're doing and how they're faring as you take the hill together. Now, you might be thinking, that kind of emotional bonding, it just ain't me. And it isn't for some people. I've seen a few capable managers run their businesses while keeping their people at arm's length. These managers often demonstrated the right values, like candor and rigor, and they delivered good results. But in never really getting inside their people, something was lost. Work stayed work. The right attitude could have made it so much more. Make that attitude yours. Rule 4. Leaders establish trust with candor, transparency, and credit. For some people, becoming a leader can be a real power trip. They relish the feeling of control over both people and information. And so they keep secrets, reveal little of their thinking about people and their performance, and hoard what they know about the business and its future. This kind of behavior certainly establishes the leader as boss, but it drains trust right out of a team. What is trust? I could give you a dictionary definition, but you know it when you feel it. Trust happens when leaders are transparent, candid, and keep their word. It's that simple. Your people should always know where they stand in terms of their performance. They have to know how the business is doing. And sometimes the news is not good, such as imminent layoffs, and any normal person would rather avoid delivering it. But you have to fight that impulse to pad or diminish hard messages, or you'll pay with your team's confidence and energy. Leaders also establish trust by giving credit where credit's due. They never score off their own people by stealing an idea and claiming it as their own. They don't kiss up and kick down because they are self-confident and mature enough to know that their team's success will get them recognition, and sooner rather than later. In bad times, leaders take responsibility for what's gone wrong. In good times, they generously pass around the praise. When you become a leader, sometimes you really feel the pull to say, "Look at what I've done." When your team excels, it's only normal to want some credit yourself. After all, you run the show. You hand out the paychecks. So people listen to your every word, or at least pretend to, and they laugh at all your jokes, or pretend to. In some cases, being boss means getting a special parking place, or traveling first class. It could go to your head. You could really start to feel pretty big. Don't let it happen. Remember, when you were made a leader, you weren't given a crown. You were given a responsibility to bring out the best in others. For that, your people need to trust you, and they will as long as you demonstrate candor, give credit, and stay real. Rule 5. Leaders have the courage to make unpopular decisions and gut calls. By nature, some people are consensus builders. Some people long to be loved by everyone. Those behaviors can really get you in the soup if you're a leader. Because no matter where you work or what you do, there are times you'll have to make hard decisions. Let people go, cut funding to a project, or close a plan. Obviously, tough calls spawn complaints and resistance. Your job is to listen and explain yourself clearly, but move forward. Do not dwell or cajole. You are not a leader to win a popularity contest. You're a leader to lead. Don't run for office. You're already elected. Sometimes making a decision is hard, not because it's unpopular, but because it comes from your gut and defies a technical rationale. Much has been written about the mystery of gut, but it's really just pattern recognition, isn't it? You've seen something so many times, you just know what's going on this time. The facts may be incomplete or the data limited, but the situation feels very, very familiar to you. Leaders are faced with gut calls all the time. You're asked to invest in a new office building, for instance, but visiting the city, you see cranes in every direction. The deal's numbers are absolutely perfect, you're told. But you've been here before. You know that overcapacity is around the corner, and the perfect investment is about to be worth 60 cents on the dollar. You've got no proof, but you've got a real uh-oh feeling in your stomach. You have to kill the deal, even if that pisses people off. Sometimes the hardest gut calls involve picking people. You meet a candidate who has all the right stuff. His resume is perfect, prestigious schools, and great experience. His interview is impressive, firm handshake, good eye contact, smart questions, and so on. But something nags at you. Maybe he's moved around an awful lot. He's just had too many jobs in too few years without a plausible enough explanation. Or his energy seems too frantic. Or one previous boss said nice things about him, but didn't sound as though he really meant them. And you're left with that uh-oh feeling in your stomach again. Don't hire the guy. You've been made a leader because you've seen more and been right more times. Listen to your gut. It's telling you something. Rule number 6. Leaders probe and push with a curiosity that borders on skepticism, making sure their questions are answered with action. When you're an individual contributor, you try to have all the answers. That's your job, to be an expert, the best at what you do, maybe even the smartest person in the room. When you're a leader, your job is to have all the questions. You have to be incredibly comfortable looking like the dumbest person in the room. Every conversation you have about a decision, a proposal, or a piece of market information has to be filled with you saying, what if, and why not, and how come? When I was first made a manager in 1963, I was running a startup with a product that went to market through a large pool sales force. I knew we weren't getting enough attention from the people in the field. So every weekend I would take home carbon copies of the sales reports filed after every customer visit, piles of them. On Mondays, I would make a pest of myself with a round of phone calls, asking the salespeople or the plant manager to explain everything I didn't understand. Why, for instance, were we giving truckload pricing to one customer for small lot sales? Why was another customer getting a product with black specs? These questions got the sales team to give our product the attention it needed and increased my understanding of how it was sold. Questioning, however, is never enough. You have to make sure your questions unleash debate and raise issues that get action. Remember, just because you are a leader, saying something doesn't mean it will happen. That was the case back in the early 90s when I was pretty much obsessed with the idea of an MRI machine with a larger opening. If you ever have had an MRI, you'll know what I'm talking about. You lie on your back and are slid inside a tunnel containing a spinning magnet. At the time, the tunnel, or bore as it was called, was very narrow, and patients were experiencing claustrophobia during the 40-minute MRI process. Word was that Hitachi was coming up with a machine with a much wider bore, but some members of our medical business dismissed the product. Hospitals, they said, would never accept the low-quality images such large bore machines produced. Having experienced an MRI myself, I just wasn't convinced. The machines did make you feel claustrophobic. Every chance I got, I asked the medical team to look at the situation again. Won't hospitals compromise image quality for patient comfort, especially for simple procedures like elbows and knees? Won't the technology eventually improve? In response, the medical team gave me the all-too-common business head fake. We'll look into it, they kept assuring me. Of course, they didn't. I was a know-nothing, meddling pain in the neck, and they were just trying to mollify me. A year later, Hitachi rolled out a large bore machine and captured a significant piece of the market. We spent 2 years playing catch-up. Now, the last thing I want to sound like with this story is a hero. Just the opposite. I should have pushed a whole lot harder with my questioning. In fact, I should have insisted we put resources into developing our own large bore machine. All we were left with at the end was me thinking, I knew it, and wanting to say, I told you so. Both of those sentiments are worth nothing. You would assume that was obvious, but I've seen more leaders believe that second-guessing absolves them from responsibility when things go wrong. Years ago, I used to see a well-known CEO socially on a fairly regular basis. Whenever his company had been in the news for screwing up, he'd always say something like, I knew they shouldn't have done that. For some reason, that made him feel better. But what did it matter? We've all been guilty at one point or another in our careers of boasting of perfect hindsight. It's a terrible sin. If you don't make sure your questions and concerns are acted upon, it doesn't count. I realize most people don't love the probing process. It's annoying to believe in a product or come into a room with a beautiful presentation, only to have it picked apart with questions from the boss. But that's the job. You want bigger and better solutions. Questions, healthy debate, decisions, and action will get everyone there. Rule number 7. Leaders inspire risk-taking and learning by setting the example. Winning companies embrace risk-taking and learning. But in reality, these two concepts often get lip service and little else. Too many managers urge their people to try new things and then whack them in the head when they fail. And too many live in not-invented-here worlds of their own making. If you want your people to experiment and expand their minds, set the example yourself. Consider risk-taking. You can create a culture that welcomes risk-taking by freely admitting your mistakes and talking about what you've learned from them. I cannot count the number of times I've told people about my first big mistake, and it was huge, blowing up a pilot plant in Pittsfield, Massachusetts in 1963. I was across the street in my office when the explosion occurred, set off by a spark igniting a large tank of volatile solution. The noise was enormous. And then roof shingles and shards of glass flew everywhere. Smoke blanketed the area. Thank God no one was hurt. Despite the enormity of my mistake, my boss's boss, a former MIT professor named Charlie Reed, did not beat me up. Instead, his sympathetic, scientific probing of the reasons for the incident taught me not only how to improve our manufacturing process, but more importantly, how to deal with people when they were down. That wasn't the only mistake in my career. I made plenty. I bought the investment bank Kidder Peabody, a cultural fit disaster, and made many wrong hires, to name just two more. These experiences were nothing to feel great about, but I talked about them openly in order to show that it was okay to take swings and miss as long as you learn from them. You don't need to be preachy or particularly somber about your errors. In fact, the more humorous and lighthearted you can be about them, the more people will get the message that mistakes aren't fatal. As for learning, again, live it yourself. Just because you're the boss doesn't mean you are the source of all knowledge. Whenever I learned about a best practice that I liked at another company, I would come back to GE and make a scene. Maybe I often overstated the case, but I wanted people to know how enthusiastic I was about the new idea. And I was. You can and should learn from one another, too. Remember that executive in Chicago who asked me how he could appraise people who were smarter than he was? The answer I gave him was, learn from them. In the best case scenario, all your people will be smarter than you. It doesn't mean you can't lead them. There is no edict in the world that will make people take risks or spend their time learning. In most cases, their risk-reward equation just isn't obvious enough. If you want to change that, set the example yourself. You'll love the exciting culture you create and the results you get. And so will your team. Rule 8. Leaders celebrate. What is it about celebrating that makes managers so nervous? Maybe throwing a party doesn't seem professional. Or it makes managers worried that they won't look serious to the powers that be. Or that, if things get too happy at the office, people will stop working their tails off. Whatever the reason, there is just not enough celebrating going on at work anywhere. When I travel, I frequently ask audiences if they've done anything to recognize their team's achievements, large or small, over the past year. I'm not talking about those stilted, company-orchestrated parties that everyone hates, in which the whole team is marched out to a local restaurant for an evening of forced merriment when they'd rather be home. I'm talking about sending a team to Disney World with their families, or giving each team member 2 tickets to a great show in New York, or handing each team member a new iPod or the like. But to my question, do you celebrate enough? Almost no one raises a hand. It's not as if GE was immune to this phenomenon. I harped on the importance of celebrating for 20 years. But during my last trip as CEO to our training center in Crotonville, I asked the 100 or so managers in the class, do you celebrate enough in your units? Even knowing what I wanted them to say, less than half answered yes. What a lost opportunity. Celebrating makes people feel like winners and creates an atmosphere of recognition and positive energy. Imagine a team winning the World Series without champagne spraying everywhere. You just can't. And yet companies win all the time and let it go without so much as a high five. Work is just too much a part of life not to recognize moments of achievement. Grab as many as you can. Make a big deal out of them. If you don't, no one will. Now, in the end, there is no easy formula for being a leader, if only. Leadership is challenging. All those balancing acts, all the responsibility, all that pressure. And yet, good leadership happens, and it comes in all kinds of packages. There are quiet leaders and bombastic ones. There are analytical leaders and more impulsive ones. Some are tough as nails with their teams, others more nurturing. On the surface, you'd be hard-pressed to say what qualities these leaders share. Underneath, though, you would surely see that the best care passionately about their people, about their growth and success. And you would see that they themselves are comfortable in their own skins. They're real, filled with candor and integrity, optimism and humanity. I'm often asked if leaders are born or made. The answer, of course, is both. Some characteristics, like IQ and energy, seem to come with the package. On the other hand, you learn some leadership skills, like self-confidence at your mother's knee, and at school, in academics and sports. And you learn others at work, through iterative experience, trying something, getting it wrong, and learning from it. Or getting it right and gaining the self-confidence to do it again, only better. For most of us, leadership happens one day when you become a boss and the rules change. Before, your job was about yourself. Now it's about them. The second chapter in the Your Company part of this book is called Hiring. What winners are made of? How to hire the right people? Sometimes when I appear before business audiences, I get a question that really stumps me, as in, I have no clue about the right answer. A couple of years ago, at a convention of insurance executives in San Diego, for instance, a woman stood up and said, "What is the one thing you should ask in an interview to help you decide whom to hire?" I shook my head. "The one thing," I said, "I can't come up with one. What do you think?" "That's why I'm asking you," she replied. The audience roared, certainly because I was so flawed, but also because they could probably relate. Hiring good people is hard. Hiring great people is brutally hard. And yet nothing matters more in winning than getting the right people on the field. All the clever strategies and advanced technologies in the world are nowhere near as effective without great people to put them to work. Because hiring is so important and so challenging, there's a lot of territory to cover in this chapter. First, we'll take a short look at three acid tests you need to conduct before you even think about hiring someone. Next, we'll lay out the 4E and 1P framework for hiring that I have used for many years. It's named after the four characteristics it contains, which all begin with E, a nice coincidence. There's a P for passion in there too. After that, we'll explore the four special characteristics you look for when hiring leaders. The previous chapter was about what you do when you're a leader, the rules for leadership, as it were. This section is about how to hire leaders in the first place. Finally, I'll answer six FAQs, frequently asked questions, about hiring that I get during my travels, plus that impossible one from that insurance executive in San Diego. After all, I've had a couple of years to think it over. First, the acid tests. Before you even think about assessing people for a job, they have to pass through three screens. Remember, these tests should come at the outset of the hiring process, not right before you're about to sign on the dotted line. The first test is for integrity. Integrity is something of a fuzzy word, so let me tell you my definition. People with integrity tell the truth, and they keep their word. They take responsibility for past actions, admit mistakes, and fix them. They know the laws of their country, industry, and company, both in letter and spirit, and abide by them. They play to win the right way by the rules. How can you test for integrity? If a candidate comes from inside your company, that's pretty easy. You've seen him or her in action or know someone who has. From the outside, you need to rely on reputation and reference checks. But those aren't foolproof. You also have to rely on your gut. Does the person seem real? Does she openly admit mistakes? Does he talk about his life with equal measures of candor and discretion? Over time, many of us develop an instinct for integrity. Don't be afraid to use it. The second test is for intelligence. That doesn't mean a person must have read Shakespeare or can solve complex physics problems. It does mean the candidate has a strong dose of intellectual curiosity, with a breadth of knowledge to work with or lead other smart people in today's complex world. Sometimes people confuse education with intelligence. I certainly did that at the start of my career. But with experience, I learned that smart people come from every kind of school. I've known many extremely bright people from places like Harvard and Yale. but some of the best executives I've worked with have attended places like Bryant University in Providence, Rhode Island, and the University of Dubuque in Iowa. GE was lucky to have all these people on its team. My point is that a candidate's education is only a piece of the picture, especially when it comes to intelligence. The third ticket to the game is maturity. You can, by the way, be mature at any age, and immature too. Regardless, there are certain traits that seem to indicate a person has grown up. The individual can withstand the heat, handle stress and setbacks, and alternatively, when those wonderful moments arise, enjoy success with equal parts of joy and humility. Mature people respect the emotions of others. They feel confident, but are not arrogant. In fact, mature people usually have a sense of humor, especially about themselves. As with integrity, there's no real test for maturity. Again, you have to rely on reference checks, reputation, and most important, gut. After passing the three acid tests, I like to think about leadership in terms of the 4E and 1P framework. And in hiring, people have used this for years. The 4E framework took years for me to solidify. No doubt other people have other frameworks that work very well in building winning teams. But I found this one was consistently effective year after year across businesses and borders. The first E is positive energy. We just talked about this characteristic in the chapter on leadership. It means the ability to go, 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 to thrive on action and relish change. People with positive energy are generally extroverted and optimistic. They make conversation and friends easily. They start the day with enthusiasm and usually end it that way too, rarely seeming to tire in the middle. They don't complain about working hard. They love to work. They also love to play. People with positive energy just love life. The second E is the ability to energize others. Positive energy is the ability to get other people revved up. People who energize can inspire their team to take on the impossible and enjoy the hell out of doing it. In fact, people would arm wrestle for the chance to work with them. Now, energizing others is not just about giving patent-esque speeches. It takes a deep knowledge of your business and strong persuasion skills to make a case that will galvanize others. A great example of an energizer is Charlene Begley, who started with GE as a financial management trainee in 1988. After several years in various jobs, Charlene was selected to run GE's Six Sigma program in the transportation business. That's where her leadership really began to shine. Galvanized by her intensity, her team really got its Six Sigma program on the corporate radar screen. It's hard to unpick Charlene's ability to energize because it's a brew of skills all mixed together. She's a great communicator who can clearly define objectives. She's dead serious about work, but she doesn't take herself too seriously. In fact, she has a good sense of humor and shares credit readily. Her attitude is always upbeat, no matter how hard the job. It can get done. Charlene's ability to energize that Six Sigma team was one of the key characteristics that got her out of the pile and set her on GE's fast track. After Six Sigma and a couple of other leadership roles, she was made head of GE's corporate audit staff and eventually became CEO of GE Fanuc Automation. Today, at 38, Charlene is CEO and president of GE's $3 billion rail business. The third E is edge, the courage to make the tough yes or no decisions. Look, the world is filled with gray. Anyone can look at an issue from every different angle. Some smart people can and will analyze those angles indefinitely. But effective people know when to stop assessing and make a tough call, even without total information. Nothing is worse than a manager at any level who can't cut bait. the type that always says, bring it back in a month, and we'll take a good hard look at it again. Or that awful type that says yes to you, and then when someone else comes in the room, changes his mind. We call these wishy-washy types last one out the door bosses. Some of the smartest people that I've hired over the years, many of them from consulting, had real difficulty with Edge, especially when they were put into operations. In every situation, they always saw too many options, which inhibited them from taking action. That indecisiveness kept their organizations in limbo. In the end, for several of them, that was a fatal flaw. Which leads us to the fourth E, execute, the ability to get the job done. Maybe this fourth E seems obvious, but for a few years, there were just the first three E's. Thinking these traits were more than sufficient, we evaluated hundreds of people and labeled a slew of them high potentials and moved many of them into managerial roles. In that period, I traveled to personnel review sessions in the field with GE's head of human resources, Bill Connedy. At the review sessions, we would refer to a single page that had each manager's photo on it, along with his or her boss's performance review and three circles, one for each E we were using at the time. Each one of these E's would be colored in to represent how well the individual was doing. For instance, a person could have a half a circle of energy, a full circle of energized, and a quarter circle of edge. Then one Friday night, after a week-long trip to our Midwestern businesses, Bill and I were flying back to headquarters, looking over page after page of high potentials, with three solidly colored in circles. Bill turned to me. You know, Jack, we're missing something, he said. We have all these great people, but some of their results stink. What was missing was execution. It turns out you can have positive energy, energize everyone around you, make hard calls, and still not get over the finish line. Being able to execute is a special and distinct skill. It means a person knows how to put decisions into action and push them forward to completion through resistance, chaos, or unexpected obstacles. People who can execute know that winning is about results. If a candidate has the four E's, then you look for that final P, passion. By passion, I mean a heartfelt, deep, and authentic excitement about work. People with passion care, really care in their bones about colleagues, employees, and friends winning. They love to learn and grow, and they get a huge kick when the people around them do the same. The funny thing about people with passion, though, is they usually aren't excited just about work. They tend to be passionate about everything. Their sports trivia nuts, or their fanatical supporters of their alma maters, or their political junkies. Whatever, they just have juice for life in their veins. Now, sometimes you have to hire for the top jobs, and there are other characteristics to consider. The three preliminary asset tests and the 4E and 1P framework apply to any hiring decision, no matter what level in the organization. But sometimes you need to hire a senior level leader, someone who's going to run a major division or entire company. In that case, there are four more highly developed characteristics that really matter. The first characteristic is authenticity. Why? It's simple. A person cannot make hard decisions, hold unpopular positions, or stand tall for what he believes unless he knows who he is and feels comfortable with that. I am talking about self-confidence and conviction. These traits make a leader bold and decisive, which is absolutely critical in times when you must act quickly. Just as important, authenticity makes leaders likable, for lack of a better word. Their realness comes across in the way they communicate and reach people on an emotional level. Their words move them. Their message touches something inside. When I was a G, we would occasionally encounter a very successful executive who just could not be promoted to the next level. In the early days, we would struggle with our reasoning. These executives demonstrated the right values and made the numbers, but usually their people did not connect with them. What was wrong? Finally, we figured out that these executives always had a certain phoniness to them. They pretended to be something they were not, more in control, more upbeat, more savvy than they really were. They didn't sweat. They didn't cry. They squirmed in their own skin, playing a role of their own inventing. Leaders cannot have an iota of fakeness. They have to know themselves so they can be straight with the world, energize followers, and lead with the authority born of authenticity. The second characteristic is the ability to see around corners. Every leader has to have a vision and the ability to predict the future. But good leaders must have a special capacity to anticipate the radically unexpected. In business, the best leaders in brutally competitive environments have a sixth sense for market changes, as well as moves by existing competitors and new entrants. The former vice chairman of GE, Paolo Fresco, is a gifted chess player. He carried that skill into every global business deal he made over the course of 30 years. Somehow, because of his intuition and savvy, he could put himself in the chair of the person across the table, allowing him to predict every move in a negotiation. To our amazement, Paolo always saw what was coming next. No one ever came close to getting the better of him because he knew what his adversary was thinking before the adversary himself knew. The ability to see around corners is the ability to imagine the unimaginable. The third characteristic is the strong penchant to surround themselves with people better and smarter than they are. Every time we had a crisis at GE, I would quickly assemble a group of the smartest, gutsiest people I could find at any level from within the company and sometimes from without, and lean on them heavily for their knowledge and advice. I would make sure everyone in the room came at the problem from a different angle, and then I would have us all wallow in the information as we worked to solve the crisis. These sessions were almost always contentious, and the opinions came at me strong and varied. And yet my best decisions arose from what I learned in these debates. Disagreements surfaced meaningful questions and forced us to challenge assumptions. Everyone came out of the experience more informed and better prepared to take on the next crisis. A good leader has the courage to put together a team of people who sometimes make him look like the dumbest person in the room. I know that sounds counterintuitive. You want your leader to be the smartest person in the room. But if he acts as if he is, he won't get half the pushback he must get to make the best decisions. The fourth characteristic is heavy-duty resilience. Every leader makes mistakes. Every leader stumbles and falls. The question with a senior-level leader is, does she learn from her mistakes, regroup, and then get going again with renewed speed, conviction, and confidence? The name for this trait is resilience, and it is so important that a leader must have it going into a job, because if she doesn't, a crisis time is too late to learn it. That is why when I placed people in new leadership situations, I always looked for candidates who had one or two very tough experiences. I particularly liked the people who had had the wind knocked clear out of them, but proved they could run even harder in the next race. The global business world today is going to knock any leader off her horse more than once. She must know how to get back in the saddle again. Finally, let's look at the six FAQs, the frequently asked questions I've received about hiring over the past several years. At the end of them, I will try, at last, to answer the insurance executive from San Diego, about the one best question to ask in an interview. As I said earlier, I've been thinking about it for a long time now. 1. How do you actually interview somebody for a job? My immediate answer to this question is, don't ever rely on one meeting. No matter how pressed for time you are, or how promising someone looks, make sure every candidate is interviewed by several people. Over time, you will find there are some people in your organization who have a special gift for picking out stars and phonies. Rely on them. Bill Carnady, my HR head, was a master at this. Whether it was with a handshake, a smile, or a way of talking about their family, job candidates were transparent to him. And listen. Listen carefully when a trusted colleague tells you that his or her gut is negatively responding to a candidate. That uh-oh feeling is usually a sign that the candidate is not what he seems. At some point in the interview process, when it's your turn, make sure you exaggerate the challenge of the open job. Describe it on its worst day: hard, contentious, political, full of uncertainty. As you crank it up, see if the candidate keeps saying yes, yes, yes. If he does, you should worry that he has few other options, if any. You may even be his sole hope of employment. Be impressed if the candidate starts peppering you back with hard questions like, how soon do you expect the results to be achieved? Or do I have enough people to make this happen? Be even more impressed if she asks you about the company's values. The difficulty of a job will bring good candidates to the edge of their seats with curiosity and firm self-confidence, not over-enthusiastic acquiescence. Finally, after all the talking is done, don't just check the references the candidate gives you. Call around. But you know that. When you do, don't allow the conversation to be perfunctory. Stop yourself from doing something natural, just hearing the good news you want to hear. Force yourself to challenge anything that sounds like lawyer speak. Use your chits. Promise you won't repeat what you hear. Doing that, you'll get what I got more times than I can count. You've got to be kidding. We were happy to get rid of that guy.